This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
By the Book on BFM 89.9.
Hello, you are listening to By the Book. I'm Lee Chui Lin, and I'm joined as always by my fellow reader, my fellow sailwoman in this sea that we call literature.
Thank you, Sharmila Ganesan.
Sharmila Ganesan. Ever since you've started kind of doing these more poetic introductions, I'm feeling under pressure.
Now I have to think of one for next week. Basically, thank you very much.
I know. We're just racing each other to the edge. Anyway, it is Lynn and Sharmila. And today, for something slightly different, we wanted to talk about reading habits because we realized that reading is one of those things where, because it's something, especially if you have been reading from a young age, it's something you do for a long time over your life and your habits change.
They definitely change. And do you get that moment when you realize you no longer read the way you used to and kind of feel ashamed of yourself?
Yes, because I used to read a lot more.
Yeah.
A lot of the books that I've spoken about on the show are books that I've read, I don't know, 5-10 years ago. It's different.
Absolutely.
Now.
Absolutely. No, and that struck me because we've been doing this show now for a few months, and so many of the examples that I pick are books that I read in the first, I'd say, 15 to 20 years of my life, because I read so much more then.
Adulting. Let's put it down to that. Let's put
adulting
it down.
Adulting is sad.
I know. Let's just put it down to that for the time being. And before we get into reading habits, might as well start with, I guess, the books that we're reading right now, because that will give us a nice window to look at now and before. So yeah. I'm currently reading What Dementia Teaches Us About Love. It's written by Nikki Gerard, and it's a sort of examination of dementia, identity, language, death, and love, and how it's all informed essentially by the death of her father from dementia and the struggles that she went through with that and without being able to care for him when he went into hospital. So it's a beautiful book, but an extremely sad one. And for that reason, I'm finding myself sort of pacing it out.
My name is Nikki Gerard, and the book I've written is called What Dementia Teaches Us About Love. It's a meditation, really, on what dementia means, not just what it means for people who live with it, for people who care for them, for the doctors and the nurses who look after them, but what it means for us as a society, psychologically, socially, emotionally, even existentially. It really tries to ask what we learn from it, what we learn about what it is to be human, about what we owe each other.
Right. Well, I'm reading a very different book, actually. I'm reading a graphic novel by Marjorie Liu called Monstrous. It's illustrated by Sana Takeda, and it is a fantasy story of an alternate reality where there are races of people who manifest like parts of their bodies or their personalities are part animal. And they are sort of ostracized by other groups of people. And so it's this very complex, almost epic world of battles and magic. And in the center of it all, a female character who discovers herself and, I suppose, how to live in a world that is, as of yet, still really prejudiced.
The world has been enchanted by the likes of Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter, and Game of Thrones. But now a new fantasy epic is brewing that you won't want to miss. What's up, everybody? My name is Joshua Yale, and I want to tell you about the next great dark fantasy epic. It's called Monstrous. It's a comic series that's been going for a few years, but has really built one story arc on top of another to become something truly special and cool and worth making a video about.
So, firstly, sounds great.
Read it. It's amazing. I'm at the latest volume, which is why I'm in the midst of reading it.
Right. That got me thinking about our topic today, which is, of course, again, reading habits. Because the first time I started reading a graphic novel, I found that there was a lot of adjustments that I had to make as a reader. You know, not going, for example, always left to right. Because the layout of something might differ. Learning to dart your eyes around the panel and to appreciate sometimes the panel as a whole piece.
Not to just read the words.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. So yeah, I think my transition from reading sort of just pure word-based novels to looking into graphic novels was actually kind of one of the first big shifts of my reading life where I was like, oh, there's a whole new way to do this.
So that's interesting, because for me, the shift happened for a much more practical reason. One is definitely that in the, I think the 2000s onwards, the whole idea of graphic novels shifted, right? They were no longer just focusing on niche superhero stories and appealing to a specific audience. They started addressing all sorts of subjects. But more importantly, around that time was also when I started struggling with time, focus, effort, energy when it came to being able to read. And in many ways, graphic novels helped me circumvent that by still being able to read things that fulfilled me, things that were deep, but they took much less time.
Yes.
And a slightly less effort as well. I'm embarrassed to say this on a book show, that I'm hosting a book show and I'm like, guys, I find it difficult to read.
I don't think you should be ashamed. This is a safe space. And on top of which, whenever people ask about reading, you know, how do you read so much? How much do you read? Those kinds of questions. My answer is always based around stamina, because I find that reading is an exercise. Like, you have to do it. You got to do it often.
Yes.
And you have to be able to make those sorts of time investments. I find it harder and harder to reach that exact stage of reading that I love so much, which is where your mind lifts out of your body and you're no longer wherever you are and you're just lost and you look up 150 pages later and go, where am I? That I find just harder and harder to come by, because it's harder for me to even invest that time to begin with, like mm-hmm. you said.
No, and I think it's a matter of distractions as well. I find myself constantly distracted by things, and that, you know, this is, people write about this all the time, we talk about this all the time, but we do live in an age where our attention has been scattered across so many things. So I find that one thing I really have to do now to be able to deep dive into a book the way you were just describing, is that not only do I have to put my phone on silent, I have to put it in a different room. Because if I see the screen light up, if I feel it vibrate, my attention is immediately away from what I'm reading and into, oh, well, what if it's important? And there is that sense of anxiety that really prevents you from being able to engage completely with the book.
And this is part of, I think, in a way, the modern second screening problem as well. The fact that nowadays, what you tend to do is you tend to do more than a thing at a time.
Yes.
So if you're watching TV at home, you also have your phone going. Mm-hmm. You know, if you are supposed to be watching a video, you might also be reading an article. Like, there are just several ways in which, like you said, it's not just your attention, it's actually your eyes, mm-hmm. what your eyes are drawn to at any given moment. So you're absolutely right. I think reading for me has become the thing where I need to set time aside to do it. It helps that my reading has always happened around bedtime. So I used to absolutely need to read before I go to bed. I've never felt the need to set myself that target. I know some people do, of something like 20 pages a day, 50 pages a day. I always thought that that would take the joy out of it. Mm-hmm. But now, like you said, like the phone trick, right? It's similar, where I have to say, nope, I'm reading now. This is it. I have put everything else aside. This is precious time for me and my books.
I think the setting time is actually significant, because it's also a part of adulting. There's just less time to do the things you like. And I find that while I am quite attuned to thinking to myself, I'm going to go home, make some dinner, have some dinner, watch an episode of whatever, whatever, and then go to bed, I don't do the same with, well, I'm going to have some dinner, put aside 2 hours, read some of this book, and then go to bed. But when I do, I actually am able to engage with it the way I was when I was younger.
I found that, just random life hack, weekend times are lovely reading times.
Yes.
Yeah, perhaps because you're less scrambly, perhaps because it feels less like an everyday task that you need to accomplish. The last time that I remember sort of having a leisurely Saturday afternoon put aside where I could just sit down and read a book was like a delight of my life. Although that, I guess, speaks to this idea of, you know how they say that fewer and fewer people read? I wonder if this is something that's in turn going to affect how people write.
So that, because do you think people might be writing to a smaller and more specific audience?
I'm wondering if people will start writing shorter and shorter pieces.
Oh, well, I never thought about that.
It was just a thought because, and I think this has been addressed on Bigger Picture or Daily Digest before, this issue of the Instagram poet.
Yes, people like Rupi Kaur.
Precisely, and how they offer you these sort of bite-sized moments of reading or literature in your day, and they have kind of found a way to seamlessly integrate themselves into the existing flow, right? So you don't have to, it's not a book, you don't have to put everything else down, pick it up, put it, you know, go somewhere, read it. Instead, it's like you're already on Instagram and here is a little dollop of something. And it's similar to Twitter, I guess. So I'm just thinking whether or not eventually literature is going to adapt in ways like Rupi Kaur to accommodate that.
Oh my goodness. No, you're not going to cry. It's okay.
It's become a strange new normal for 25-year-old Rupi Kaur. Fans eager to share how her work has changed their lives. There's often a photo and a hug. Sometimes the exchange becomes emotional.
It's because you remind me of my mom.
Yeah.
It's so nice. I still don't believe it. Like, I have to pinch myself. It's real, but it still doesn't feel real.
And how could it? Kaur's debut collection of poems, Milk and Honey, has sold 3 million copies worldwide. And her new work, The Sun and Her Flowers, has already sold 1 million since its release in October. Meanwhile, performances of her poetry, like this one in Washington, D.C. recently, routinely draw hundreds.
There are mountains growing beneath our feet that cannot be contained. All we've endured has prepared us for this. Bring your hammers and fists. We have a glass ceiling to shatter.
So the extension of that is also the idea that book authors now have to appeal to a more online audience, right? How do you make a book visual? So when you talk about book trailers, when you talk about being able to do readings, when you talk about being snappy, I mean, a Stephen King or a Neil Gaiman make much better sound bites and video clips than perhaps a poet who is much more interior, or, you know, any writer really who just wants to write. And does that choice still exist anymore?
I don't know. Yeah. Do you struggle with reading? This is sort of a, I guess, a book reader struggles anonymous kind of show.
I mean, we're not anonymous, but you can be.
You can be. You can absolutely be. Tell us, are you having trouble finding the time to read? Are your reading habits just not what they used to be? How have you found ways to cope with that? WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. Tweet us at BFM Radio and write us at buythebook@bfm.my.
Best flipping moments. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, you are listening to Buy the Book with Lynn and Sharmila. We are talking today about reading habits and how the good old days, we're just not there anymore. And how we used to read a lot more when we were younger, I think is what it comes down to. Which brings me to another point, which is that I now read an awful lot for work.
And of course.
Yes. And that, I mean, those author interviews don't just interview themselves. So it's been an interesting experience because I have always read for pleasure. I've always read because I wanted to. And in a way, I'm really enjoying the broadening of my horizons that has come with not always getting 100% say in what I have to read next. And it's resulted in actually some really good reads this year. So it's good on that side. It's also been a lot of pressure on the other.
No, because you only have a certain amount of space in your life for the books you're reading. So every time you put one book into that space, you have to take something else that you might have read otherwise. But I am going to contradict myself there and say that often I think that might be an excuse I make because I might think I kept that space for a book, but as to whether I'm really reading something else, I'm not really sure.
There's so much guilt in your voice.
I know. This is really something I'm laughing, but it's something I'm actually quite ashamed about because I used to be that kid that adults in my life used to say, well, she always has her nose in a book. And I literally did. I tried to read in cinemas.
I read at weddings.
Yes, I've taken a book to a wedding and then been told off.
Yes.
But reading for work, absolutely, I think is one of those things that I try to, I think, co-opt to to circumvent some of these problems that I had. So when I used to work at the Star before I joined BFM, and when time came for me to propose the idea for a books column, I decided what I would do is actually use it as a way to read all of these big classics that they keep telling you you should read. So my column there is called Booked Out. And essentially what I've been doing for the last, it must be nearly 4 years now, trying to read the books that are listed in the 1,000 books you must read before you die.
Bless you.
I haven't read even half of them because it is a monthly column, hello. But I agree that what it does do is sort of force me to pick the books that I wouldn't usually go towards. One thing I do try to do with the column, though, is to be absolutely honest. If I couldn't get through a book, or if I abandoned it halfway, or if I found it boring, and, you know, even if it is the book you must read before you die, I'm usually quite honest about it, which I think is important.
That is also a separate sort of pressure, right, that I think a lot of people feel, which is that... Well, if you studied literature in school, which I did as a course, then I think there is sometimes this idea also that you're not an informed person if you haven't read XYZ. You know, if you haven't read all of James Joyce, if you haven't read, you know, Herman Melville.
Moby Dick, Dostoevsky.
Yeah, you know, your Kafka's. And yeah,
if they're all men. They're all men, aren't
they? So that's the thing, right? So if you haven't read these sort of grand, great classics. So as a child, I read a number of the abridged versions of these sorts of things. You know, I read Oliver Twist that way and, you know, other books like that. However, as an adult, it returns because it's like, come on, the abridged version, you can do better than that. And I have kind of, I find that it can be a both trying and rewarding experience to try to go through the classics. Because sometimes, like in the case of Great Expectations, just a really good book.
Yes, Great Expectations was... I watched the movie first before I read the book, and then I read the book and I thought, wow, I'm glad I did this.
Yeah, despite the fact that I was a little bit young, so some elements of the language and the historical stuff I didn't get. But that didn't change the fact that at the end... Is this a spoiler?
Can we spoil Dickens? I think we can.
We can.
The statute of limitations has run out.
So I think at the end, when you see what happens with Pip, when Pip has his encounter with... It's just my heart melted. And I didn't think that a classic book could make me feel that way. I think if you're raised on a diet of pop literature, as we both were in many ways, sometimes the classics can feel hugely intimidating. They can feel really like... Oh, these are, you know, olden days and olden cultures, and it's just not for me. Mm-hmm. So to be moved, and Great Expectations, I think, is my first experience of that happening, where I read something that was a certifiable classic and found myself just astonished by it the way I would be by a blockbuster.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was special.
According to my experience, the conventional notion of a lover cannot be always true. The unqualified truth is that when I loved Estella with the love of a man, I loved her simply because I found her irresistible. Once for all, I knew to my sorrow, often and often, if not always, that I loved her against reason, against promise, against peace, against hope, against happiness, against all discouragement that could be.
But the opposite is also true, isn't
yes.
it? Where you feel compelled to make your way through these books. And those needn't be just the classics. They're also the Man Bookers and the Pulitzer winners, where you feel compelled to go through them because it's what all the literary critics and experts are telling you you should read. But then you read them and you're just like, I cannot get through this book. Not another despairing person on a journey to discover themselves. Like, I just want some space.
I think we had this conversation about Arundhati Roy.
Yeah.
Because her book was so eagerly anticipated by so many people.
The second book, The Ministry of Utmost Happiness.
Yes. That book, I remember us talking about it and how we both were fans of Arundhati Roy's first, The God yes. of Small Things. And now... You find yourself with this book that everybody is like, she's done it, it's finally out. And then I couldn't get through it.
I quit after the first or second chapter. I don't know. And, you know, for that very reason, I actually haven't revisited The God of Small Things because I remember being so captivated by it when I was that age.
But who knows now?
And who knows now? And I'm a bit scared. And I tend to feel that way about a lot of books.
So with the classics as well, I think the reason why it sometimes feels as if you can always revisit it is because it's not always zeitgeisty. It's not always part of the conversation at the moment. So it feels like they're the old reliables that will always be there for you. You can go back to your bookshelves anytime you want to pick them up. But that also then results in, I think, unless you make, like yourself, some sort of...
figure out a column that you can write.
Or some other way of forcing yourself to sit down and actually do this. I know lots of people who would do that, who would say, there is this list, I'm going to do it. You know,
disciplined people.
And that also is about your relationship with reading, I think. It's like, why are you reading? Are you reading purely... I'm a little bit of a centralist when it comes to reading. I read really for pleasure, you know. If I'm enjoying the book, then that's it. That's all I need. On the other hand, if I'm not and you tell me, no, this is a vitamin, it's good for you, you will learn things, that's a bit more of a struggle.
No, absolutely. Because I think of the kinds of things that I was reading as a child and as a teenager. And I look at the kind of, I suppose, the patronizing attitudes we tend to take as adults to things kids read. Oh, you're reading Twilight? There's so many better things you could be reading. Yes, there are other things you could be reading, but you're getting pleasure out of reading.
I'd never given much thought to how I would die, though I'd had reason enough in the last few months. But even if I had, I would not have imagined it like this. I stared without breathing across the long room into the dark eyes of the hunter, and he looked pleasantly back at me. Surely it was a good way to die, in the place of someone else, someone I loved, noble even.
And it doesn't matter. To me, the main thing is really that once you learn to love to read, I think you will read other things. You're not going to be reading Twilight into your 40s or 50s. Well, if you are, there's nothing wrong with it.
Yes, people do. But I agree that better to read anything, you know, than to have just lost the sense of reading entirely. And that's why Dickens is easy for me to go through. I mean, not to harp on the classics, but I think clearly I feel a lot of unresolved guilt over not having gone through a lot of them. But something like Dickens I found really easy. Something like Jules Verne, you know, just a deep pleasure in reading that. No issue. Great story.
There remained then only two possible solutions of the question, which created two distinct parties. On one side, those who were for a monster of colossal strength. On the other, those who were for a submarine vessel of enormous motive power.
It's the other stuff, the more metaphysical, the more...
I find the Russian writers difficult, for instance.
Sure.
Yeah, and my sister is a great fan. She keeps telling me I should read them. I find those difficult. But then conversely, something like Voltaire, which I thought I would have an issue with, I read that actually quite recently for my column, and I was like, he's so clever. He's so smart. I feel like I'm reading a satirist today.
That's how I felt, and I've been a lifelong fan. That's how I felt about Oscar Wilde.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, who is also one of those classic writers, you know, whether or not it's The Importance of Being Earnest or Picture of Dorian Gray, people will tell you at some point, read Oscar Wilde.
Yeah.
And I read Oscar Wilde and I thought, this is a breeze. And then I read all of it.
Her mother is an absolute gorgon. I don't really know what a gorgon is, but I'm quite sure that Lady Bracknell is one. In any case, she's a monster without being a miss, which is rather unfair. Aldrin. You don't suppose that Gwendolyn will become like her mother in about 150 years, do you?
All women become like their mothers. That is their tragedy. No man does. That's his.
It's just such a delight being in his company. So it really depends, I think, on what you want to get out of reading. However, okay, so we've been kind of telling people all our problems for a bit now.
Confessional.
Basically that. Confession. We produce a book show. We wish we read more. How do you try to read more? How do you try to encourage yourself to do that?
So you don't mean for work, right? You mean the books that I'm not necessarily reading for work.
How do you ensure that your relationship with yourself as a reader stays healthy?
That is a great question.
Thank you.
One is to separate the reading from it feeling, and you said this earlier, from it feeling like I have to. So I take a book with me wherever I go, and you know, if I'm in, and I associate it with pleasure. So having a coffee, reading, finding a nice spot, reading, being on holiday with a book, and then yes, reading it. I have tried not to do it in bed at night because with age comes the tendency to fall asleep while you're reading.
Yes. I've bonked myself on the head really hard.
Me
once.
Too.
Yeah, it's awful.
And sometimes I read with an e-reader. So what happens is my nose just turns it 40 pages away. yes. So it's essentially recapturing, I think, that feeling that I used to have as a child where reading was this little magical space that I created for myself. And it was only for myself. And I associated it with no matter what else is wrong with the world, I still have my books.
Yes. Yeah. And also the fact that there are memories attached to those books, right? Like the things that you're describing are very sensorial things, going on holiday, finding a nice park, not in Malaysia, to sit and read a book. Those are things that I have with my books, especially the books that I've taken away with me. And I try to hold on to that feeling. So aside from, like you said, creating that space, mm-hmm, being conscious that the phone is not your friend in yes, this moment. I also keep a running list of all the books I've read, especially in a year. I try to make a little note of when I finished it. And I find that just by having the existence of this list, A, it lets me know when I've been falling behind. You know, it lets me know if I open it up and I go like, oof, I've only read 5 books this year. What went wrong? You know, that sort of thing. But it also prompts memories associated with that book.
Yes.
It reminds me why I loved it. It reminds me of the experiences that I had while reading it or why I felt so deeply for it. And that goes a long way, I think, towards reminding me, hey, idiot, you love to read. Remember to read. So that's it.
So, you know, speaking of creating memories, I think one thing that I do try to do now, especially as an adult, is I try and talk about the books I'm reading, not just to tweet about it, or like we do now.
So you've co-opted your column to read the classics, and you've co-opted this show.
I have. I've been co-opting everything in my life so that I can read more.
You're so good at adulting.
Thank you. Thank you. I make it work. But I think that it helps because talking about the books you read and relating it to the things you go through, telling people, even if they're never going to read it, but to tell them why you read it and why it gave you so much pleasure, helps me want to continue doing it.
Have you also been struggling with your relationship with yourself as a reader? You know, is
it's
this
starting to turn into an agony aunt?
I know, a little bit. Just for readers, just for people who look at their books languishing on their bookshelves and go, "I miss you." Do you have that feeling? What do you do to try and ensure that you know you do still have that space to read in your life? WhatsApp us your thoughts 018-789-8899. You can also tweet us at BFM Radio and write us at buythebook@bfm.my. And now we come to footnotes. Sorry about that. I mean, I feel like we've just spent the last half hour or so unburdening ourselves on you, all our woes. And now we're going to talk about organization. So, of course, there has been a little bit of misunderstanding about this. Marie Kondo, for example, copped a bit of controversy over this perception that people thought she was telling people to throw away their books. She has, however, since clarified this.
What about books? There was a lot of talk online over the last couple of days about some people took umbrage at the idea of getting rid of books and that not all books are supposed to spark joy. They're supposed to spark all sorts of emotions, but there's something special about books. And how do you feel? Tell us a bit about your philosophy.
So I love that actually, because the point of the KonMari method is to figure out your sense of value. What do you hold most important? So if you're angered, if your reaction is anger that you have to let go of books, then that's great because that means for you, books is invaluable. Books are invaluable. The idea is that if it sparks joy for you, you must keep it. Even if I go over to your home and I say, do you really want to keep this book? If you feel that it sparks joy for you, keep it with confidence.
But that doesn't change the fact that organization is clearly a big thing for a lot of people. I mean, you have some folks doing the KonMari method. You have people kind of organizing their books in different forms.
By color, God forbid.
And yet how beautiful. Okay, we'll get to that. We'll get to that. So we want to know firstly, how do you, after you tell us how you get yourself to read more, we also want to know, how do you organize your books? You can tell us 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio, write us, remember, at buythebook@bfm.my. Sharmila, putting you on the spot. How do you do it?
I'm actually quite anal about how I arrange my books. So,
hence the dismissive quality about color.
About colors, yes. Alphabetical, for sure. Alphabetical by author's last name, right? And then within the author's, I'm starting to sound slightly crazy, I know. Within the author's collection of books, if they have done different genres, then I might, for instance, if I did an Isaac Asimov, I would put his science fiction in a separate section of a shelf versus where I would put his essays or his nonfiction, for instance.
Sure. I start off with the very best of intentions. I organize my bookshelves maybe once every, used to be once a year. Now it's stretching out to like once every five or something. So I try to come up with an order that I know will see me through for a number of years. And I organize according to genre. So I've got my classics shelf, I've got my anthology shelf, and then you've got the nonfictions, you've got the horror, the sci-fi, and then sort of the general. So I try to follow bookshop principles, basically. And then once I've got that going, then, like you said, exactly right, you have organized by authors' last names. And then what happens after that, though, is that it becomes very difficult for me to put things back exactly where I found them or to fit new books in. And then that's where the stacks start to grow. So I don't want to sit here and pretend like I have a lovely ordered shelf and that's all I have, when really I have that. And then I also have stacks of books.
Well, no, the stacks is a real thing, right? Because you haven't accounted for the new books that you buy.
Yes.
So I always, with the best of intentions, leave gaps in my, especially like, for instance, when I started arranging Neil Gaiman section, I thought to myself, well, I'm going to buy new Neil Gaiman books. He's still around. He's going to write new books. And then the stacks start, because you never account for all of the books that you think you're going to buy.
Fascinating. Learning so much about you today. Because even my stacks are divided into going to read soon, bought a long time ago at a bookshop or at a book sale, and always intend to read, have not read. So I've got different sort of stacks scattered throughout the house, depending on when it is that I plan to read them. So the stack that is right next to my bed is the most... most likely to get love, you know, most likely to actually be read. And then throughout the room, I've got just different ones layered. It's a mess, you guys. I think maybe that's contributing to the
lack
reading
of
problem.
Being able to read. No, I definitely have a stack to be read. And that's the pile that I put next to my bed as well. Alongside that stack, I also have the guilt pile, which is that you bought these because you were going to read them, so you have to read them, that pile.
We should talk about throwing books away or giving books away, because, I mean, I mentioned Marie Kondo in brief earlier, but she did really cop a lot of heat for suggesting that people should give their books away or should throw their books away, that it was, you know, books are part of the problem. And of course, a lot of book readers, book lovers united and, you know, shouted her down. But like, there is something to that, isn't there? I mean, I've read lots of books that I've forgotten.
Yes.
I also have lots of books in my bookshelf that I don't remember reading, even though I know I did. And you do sometimes hit a point, especially as a lover of physical books, not e-books. You do hit a point where you have to question
life's choices.
I mean, am I keeping this around now because I want a full library? Am I keeping this around because I think I will loan it out someday? Am I keeping this around because I think I'll read it again? So at some point, I mean, I do look at the books that I hold on to and I wonder why. Doesn't mean that I am any closer to giving them away, but I do have a moment of doubt.
So having had to move 3 times in the last 7 or 8 years, I really have become a lot less, attached to my books, to the physical books. So the books I know I'll read again and again, those I will definitely keep and I'm not giving them away. However, the books that I know for a fact that I'm only going to read once and I'm very certain I'm not going to read them again, often what I find myself doing is, if someone tells me that they've been wanting to read that book, I'll usually tell them, I have a copy of it and you can have it, because I won't read it again. And it actually makes me feel good. It makes me feel good to think that I'm giving the book to someone who's actually going to read it.
I have not reached your level of enlightenment, but what I do like to do is to regard my bookshelf as a library. And I mean that in the sense that people can come over. So if I have people visiting from abroad and they're, you know, kind of bunking in the house, then look at all these books. I've loaned books to people who were passing through. I've loaned books to people who just said, I want to read something. Mm-hmm. What should it be? And when that happens, I'm really grateful that I have such a large selection to choose from. So I have not hit the point where it feels good to give a book away.
No, you only reach that point when you find yourself lying on the floor surrounded by piles of books and crying because you don't know how to carry them to your next apartment.
Sure. Okay. Okay. So yeah. What you're saying is...
It takes some time. Some emotional investment.
Yes, that and life choices, like life circumstances and choices. I see now. Okay. And before we close off, is it that bad to think about color? I mean,
no, you know why? Because I actually love looking at those pictures of bookshelves that are organized by colors. They look so pretty.
Sometimes by size too.
Yeah, but I have no idea how I would find anything. I mean, unless I remember that this book had this colored cover and therefore it's going to be here. I think if you're a very Instagrammy person, or if your bookshelf is in your living room, that makes sense.
I was going to say, I'm a bit torn because like you, I do think it's beautiful to look at. It's really glorious. And we're going to talk about book covers on a later show because that's a real thing, right? Why people buy books, why people like how books look. So I appreciate that sometimes you just want to showcase your books, but you're right. It's so impossible to find. And especially if you have a larger library with a variety of types of books, then you're just dead in
the
water.
Or you have like 300 black books, which I suspect I might.
Yeah, because it's about the spine, isn't it? So, yeah. Okay, tell us, how do you organize your books? You know, and have you reached the point where you can just give them away and feel good about that? Or are you still like me and kind of feeding that little hoarder fire that lives in my belly? You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio, and write us at buythebook@bfm.my.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.